Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Wednesday, February 6th, 2019. Today, I have Charlotte Henry with me. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello.
Also with me today, I have Dave Hamilton. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So the first thing we want to talk about today is we want to talk about some executive shuffling over at Apple. We're going to talk about how Angela Ahrendts is leaving Apple retail, and that position is temporarily being taken over by the senior vice president of people, who's going to be people and retail in the short term. Right, Charlotte?
Well, Apple haven't said it's the short term. It's her name's Deirdre O'Brien, and she's a 30-year Apple vet. And as you said, she's now going to have the title head of people, senior vice president, people and retail. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of speculation that this is not a long-term appointment. Those two jobs seem too big to combine into one person, however talented and dedicated to the cause she may be. Mm-hmm.
Well, retail's like a huge portion of what Apple does. And, you know, if it's a temporary thing, I guess it makes a certain amount of sense since a whole lot of people are involved in Apple retail. So being the head of both, like, at least there's some overlap there. And it's not like, you know, engineering is now taking over, like, managing retail in the short term or anything like that.
Right. And that was clearly the logic. But a lot of people are speculating that, A, this is a surprise that Angela Ahrendts is leaving. And I think it is a surprise. And we can talk about that. But I also think there is a lot of merit to the suggestions that this is not going to be a long-term appointment, that this is someone, a trusted person who has been at Apple a long time, who can come in and hold the fort before the next Angela arrives.
Yeah. Now, Dave, what's your take on this?
You know, Apple's the sentiment and culture of Apple's retail has changed a few times over the years. Mm-hmm. You know, and one thing that I have heard as a complaint from lots of folks who work in Apple retail and also folks that work for third party, like Apple authorized shops, is that the obsession with metrics was something new that Angela Ahrendts brought to the table, and in many of people's opinions, ruined the Apple retail experience because it took a lot of the customer service leeway away from the folks on the front lines and codified it all. So it's interesting to see her leave. And from that standpoint, I'm kind of excited for those people and for us as customers to see, you know, how that works and how it affects like the whole tech support side of it. But yeah, having not a clear plan, I think Apple was, yeah, a little blindsided by her leaving. Otherwise, they would have had someone more permanent, perhaps, in place. I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to say, right?
Well, yeah. I've seen, like, it definitely seems surprising because I think it was about a week ago there was an interview with Angela Ahrendts in, I don't remember, I believe it was a magazine, but I don't remember which one, where she talked about having loved being in the fashion industry and doing that for a lot of years. But when Apple called, of course, she answered and, you know, felt it necessary to make the switch over and go to Apple from fashion. And, you know, and it was something, you know, like, I feel like this is another one of those cases. I feel like I say this a lot on this show, where there's a piece of information that as of now, we do not have.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I feel like that piece of information is whatever company it is that made Angela an offer that she really wants to take.
So of course, yeah. And that's, you know, when you said that it was a surprise that she left, I believe you that you're surprised. I also believe that people at Apple were surprised. But yeah. But as an employer, and I say this as an employer who has been surprised by people leaving, you should never be surprised when someone who is an employee of yours takes an offer elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's loyalty. There's more loyalty. I think I'm saying this accurately, but you know, the loyalty from employer from employee to employer really ends with what's best for the employee.
Yeah.
And that's as it should be. Like, that should not be a surprise to anyone, but it often is anyway, because we're humans and we have expectations that, you know, go beyond that which is logical and all of those things. And sometimes right. those expectations are right. So yeah, it I'm sure it was a surprise, but and that no one was expecting, and that's they should have. But
well,
you know,
I think it's surprising. I don't think it's surprising that she left. I think it's just that it was like that it was right now and yeah. right after this interview about how, you know, she's at Apple and really digs it and you know, had a bunch of nice stuff to say. So I think that's really the like I'm not surprised she left. I just sort of assumed at some point she would do all that she had done, all that she had felt yeah. she could do for Apple and move on. Like, I never expected her to be there forever. Like, that was, you know, that was never the case.
No, she came in as a high level employee and right. generally, you know, and she was brought in to do a thing mm-hmm. and she did that thing. And now it's not a change anymore. It's okay. We've done it. It's, you know, it's back mm-hmm. to smooth sailing. And oftentimes that's the time when someone like that is brought in to do a thing somewhere else.
Right.
Yes. But what I did find surprising about this is, as we've all identified, retailers become a much bigger part of Apple. Look at the huge store that Angela Ahrendts opened, and she was a key part of the opening in Thailand, for mm-hmm. example. As I understand it, the Fifth Avenue store is still not open yet, is it?
No,
that has not reappeared. And so I still am... I take on board all that Dave said, and it's all very fair points, but I think it is still somewhat surprising that given the revolution that is still ongoing, I don't think you can say the way that Apple retail is being changed has finished. That program to me does not feel finished, and I am surprised that she has decided to leave at this point.
Well, I sort of am, but I feel like part of what she came in to do wasn't quite as much the stores themselves, although some of them have been great, like the one in Chicago that I'm not yep. going to remember where it is, the one in San Francisco where, you know, there's those giant glass panels that open up, and I'm not going to remember which one that is either, but I've been there. They fixed my Apple Watch for me. And there's the trees out front, and there's like the little concourse area where you can sort of hang out, but you're also sitting kind of in an Apple store.
I mean, like, she's totally
that's really cool.
changed all that.
Right.
But she's totally changed that with these more communal areas. She understood that they were a place, they had to design a place where you could hang out as well as buy stuff.
Right.
So I find it really interesting, Dave's point about the metrics, because actually, I have actually seen this with my experience in UK Apple stores. I had quite a traumatic and major MacBook Pro failing not that long ago. It's long ago that I can talk about it now, but still, it still brings back certain traumas. And I sat in the Apple store in my local shopping mall for a good couple of hours, mm-hmm. Backing up my entire hard drive, basically, I'm sure in previous years, the Apple store, the Genius Bar guy would have sat with me for a bit and helped me. Now, as it happens, I'm more than capable of doing that. But essentially, I was doing in the Apple store what I could have done largely at home, and he just carried on serving other people. Uh-huh. Now, is that because there is a metric brought in from on high that they just have to keep serving people as opposed to that customer service experience that Dave was mentioning before?
Yeah, it could be, right? Yeah. That certainly sounds in line with the other things that I've heard from folks there. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, what's interesting to me about this is when you look at the leadership of the of Apple retail over time, right? So mm-hmm. Ron Johnson came in to build it. Basically, he came from Target, and Ron Johnson helped sort of at least initially like 1.0 shape the Apple store, when we all sort of made fun of how it looked like the Gap and there weren't any shelves with anything on them, and that was all you got, right? And then, you know, from there that evolved into what ended up being called the Stanford style store. And remember, this is a point when Steve Jobs was still personally approving every Apple store design, and we went from that, from now, like, Apple is an established presence. And remember, for people who don't remember, gather around, it's story time. Dave and I are going to talk to you about how everybody thought Apple was losing their fool minds by building retail stores just to go buy Apple stuff, because who goes and buys Apple stuff?
Well, who goes to retail stores was the other question, right? Like, right. They were building these.
There were two questions.
Yeah. When the internet was like being the thing that was like, no. You know, no brick and click, just click, you know.
Yeah.
And Gateway had failed miraculously with their stores. But
spectacularly.
That was just
yes.
But that was a weird thing, because you would go into this store, sit down in front of a computer and order your Gateway that right. would then be shipped to your house.
Right.
So that was a little weird. You'd leave
it was
with
very
a mug
odd.
After you bought a computer. No wonder they failed. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first Apple Stores app opened in 2001, right? I think is when that was. I don't.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
It seems like it was 2001. So yeah. We got a couple of Apple Stores in 2001, and then, you know, a couple more and a couple more over time. And now there's over 500 of them in all kinds of countries, all over the place. And so part of what was interesting to me was, you know, Ron Johnson helped establish that Apple retail is a thing. It's not going away. And this is a place that you can go and have a very good experience, because, you know, all of us can tell you stories, all the old school people, that is, can tell you stories about trying to go buy Apple stuff in a store before there were Apple stores. And hijinks ensued. Let's just put it that way. I have a friend who went into a CompUSA to buy a cable for his iMac, and they tried to sell him a Windows machine instead of a cable. And I think everyone I know has some story like that. And the other thing that I wonder about is, you know, like, Ron Johnson came in to establish the brand, and then we got Angela Ahrens, who gave us sort of the upscaling of that. Like, I feel like that was part of what she was brought in to do, was make it fashionable and do things like these new style stores and the Today at Apple program, you know, so that people do come and hang out, and it's more of a draw, like, as a lifestyle sort of thing than it is, you know, I have to go there because the screen on my iPhone is cracked, right? Like, you want to go there and you want to hang out and spend some time. And so what I'm curious about is, when they bring in the next person to be the head of retail, what it is they're bringing that person in, what sort of intentions they bring that person in under, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. That person will have marching orders and presumably some latitude to, you know, go and get these things done in their own style. But
sure.
Definitely marching orders. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And the person that they bring in is going to tell us something about, because, you know, we got Angela Ahrens straight from Burberry. And so that told us, like, she's a person from the fashion world and making things fashionable, and, you know, being able, you know, which is different from trendy. Fashionable and trendy are not the same thing. And so, like, that was the thing that she was brought in to sort of do. And, like, it does, at least to me, it seems like Apple stores have gotten cooler. Maybe it's just because I've gotten a couple new ones here that we didn't
have
before.
Yeah.
I think it's worth reflecting also on Angela Ahrens' time at Burberry, because I think that can be overlooked by us who predominantly follow tech. Burberry was almost on its knees before she came back. It was seen it's obviously a UK brand. It was seen as a very stuffy, old fashioned, maybe classic if you were being generous, but not particularly fashionable.
Right.
She changed that.
Okay.
She opened it. I think, you know, there are beautiful Burberry stores now on London's Oxford Street, which is one of the main shopping streets here. There, it's a huge, huge change in the company's fortunes that she oversaw, which is obviously one of the things that attracted Apple to employing her. But
sure.
Also, that is clearly also what they brought her in to do at Apple, is that she had turned this ship around at Burberry. And mm-hmm. and so that was obviously what was needed, that they felt was needed with Apple retail as well.
Mm-hmm. And for people who absolutely do not follow fashion in any way, shape or form, when we talk about Burberry, the thing that you will most associate with Burberry is the brown scarf with the black and white plaid that has the little bits of red in it. That's a Burberry scarf. So for people who don't know.
Or the trench coat.
Right.
coat.
Those are the two things that we talk about the most. So I am interested in what the next phase of Apple retail is going to look like as a result of whoever it is they bring in. So Dave, do you have any speculation on that? Like, what the next phase will be, not who they bring, but where it's going to go from here.
No. Well, yeah, maybe. Like, do they bring someone in? This is probably wishful thinking, but also reactionary to what I was saying before. I'll stick with the same thread. Do they bring someone in who's a customer service ninja, right? Mm-hmm. And focus more now that they've got the experiential part of it down, but the customer has gotten lost in this. Like, if you compare the two phases, I think there's, you know, there's no question that there's some level of that. They point to their customers, their CustSat numbers or whatever the heck it is that Tim likes to say, you know, but like, I think they need to bring somebody in who realizes that every business is the customer service business. And how do we take what we know we need to do and yet still package that in a way that is, you know, friendly and understanding to our customers? Because let's face it,
right?
Apple support has been a thing that was a thing that really carried them forward as a brand and with customer loyalty and all of that. And their support has gotten worse.
Yeah. Cause there was no loyalty if you didn't have aftercare.
Correct.
You know, like nobody wants to come buy another Mac or another iPhone if you had a really hard time getting help with the one that you have. You don't want to buy another one. And that's kind of where some people are. Like, I've seen some people who have switched because they're like, you know, most of what I do is on my phone. And, you know, every time I go to an Apple store to sort something out with my phone, it ends up being a disaster area. So I got an Android phone and I feel better now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm curious about that. And I hope that that's what they do. I'm not convinced that that's what they will decide to do, but I'm hoping. So there you go.
Yeah.
I definitely feel that the customer service experience has got worse in Apple stores. I think that I sometimes try to attribute it to there was just more people to serve. It's harder to serve people better if there's loads of them. We know this. But also, I do think that is a quite serious point that, you know, me sitting in a packed Genius Bar for 2 hours by myself, or, you know, the fact that actually it's quite difficult to get a Genius Bar appointment now if you need it. And like turning up to someone who's a bit grumpy and overwhelmed with an iPad who says, no, you've got to come back in 3 days when you're desperate because your computer that's your whole life is dying.
Right.
Like that type of stuff does need to be fixed. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah. And I'm hopeful that that's the direction they end up going. Like Dave said, that's sort of my hope, is that the customer experience becomes the thing that's front and center. And I think it was the thing that Ron Johnson sort of held onto, which is part of why we got, when we initially got the stores, like the experience was the part that was nice about it, you know, because like, you know, I've said before, like people used to talk about, I have to go get my computer fixed or whatever. And then it was like, I'm going to the Apple store, or I get to go to the Apple store, you know, and it wasn't like I have to, because it wasn't tedium. It wasn't aggravating. You know, it wasn't the more frustrating experience that it has become now, because people now are saying, I have to go to the Apple store, get my phone fixed, get my battery replaced, whatever it is. So I'm interested to see where that goes. I think it's going to be, I think it's going to tell us more. And as soon as we find out who that is, and we can talk a little bit more about that person in particular. For right now, what I want to do is talk about our sponsor today, which is ExpressVPN. And oddly, today we don't have a security thing to discuss, but generally we do. And when we talk about security breaches, it's hard not to take that information and apply it to your own life and figure out where your own data is going and what's actually happening to it. So if you're buying something on your phone, or maybe you're on your iPad checking your mail and you're using public Wi-Fi, like that is a thing that could potentially put your information at risk. And that's if you're doing something consciously on public Wi-Fi. That doesn't count all of the Facebook tracking or other social media sites that are tracking you, or even your mobile provider or your ISP who is taking that data and selling it to other companies so that they can profit off your browser history and the kind of activity that you have online. So you can keep some of that stuff from happening by using a VPN service, and you should be using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN has easy to use apps. They run easily in the background. It's one click to turn it on and turn it off. You can do that on both your computer and your mobile devices. So your iPhone and your iPad and your Mac, all of them have a very easy app to use from ExpressVPN to turn it on and turn it off. So you can use that to secure your data and anonymize your internet browsing. thing, all of that data gets encrypted and your public IP address is hidden. So aside from that, you can get all of this protection for less than $7 a month. It's the number one rated VPN service by TechRadar, and you get a 30-day money-back guarantee. You can get all of this, including 3 months free with a 1-year package, if you go to expressvpn.com/TDO. That's expressvpn.com/TDO. You can learn more. And like I said, you can get 3 months free. So the other thing I want to talk about with you both today, first of all, I want to ask Dave about this in particular. We've seen a couple of big purchases from Spotify. They bought both Gimlet and Anchor. And Dave, let's start at the beginning. What's Gimlet and what's Anchor? So, and then we'll talk about why Spotify cares about buying them.
Right. Yeah. So Gimlet is a company that's actually been going around acquiring other companies for a while, but they create their own podcasts. They also sell ads, of course, on those podcasts and on others with whom they partner. And so they are, I would say, most definitely a content creation organization. And in addition to being publisher support and all of those things, but they have been, there to help build podcasting and increase its value and all of those things. I mean, it's certainly, I'm sure there's people out there, you know, waving their arms saying, but I don't like that Gimlet did this. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Like that happens. But in general, I think they're one of the good people, right? You know, they're out there. Certainly they're, you know, obviously out for their own profit and all that, but that's because they're a company and that's how that works. But yeah, they've been doing good things and profiting by helping people. So that does that explain Gimlet well enough?
I think so. Yeah.
I think. Okay, yeah. Cool. So then there is Anchor, who is a relatively new company that came onto the market to help people make podcasts and publish podcasts. They basically mm-hmm. built an engine that allows you, you know, you sitting there at home or really not even at home, like anywhere, mm-hmm. and you can record, produce and release and get distribution for your own podcast. And on the surface, that sounds fantastic. and I think that is actually, but I led that way because I think this is what Spotify just bought, is those two things, right? Like this company that produces mm-hmm. podcasts and creates their own. And then they bought this company that has an engine that lets anyone create their own. Mm-hmm. Anchor has gotten a lot of bad press from podcasters specifically because they have very draconian terms. They want to own your content in certain ways. I don't want to miscategorize, so I'm not going to get too specific with it because I'm not really all that well versed with it. But it's basically, if you talk to established podcasters who have dug into this, they will almost universally tell you, stay away from Anchor. They're terrible. They're terrible. Stay away. So, but mm-hmm. again, I don't think Spotify cared about that.
The reason people who are podcasters do not have goodwill in their hearts for Anchor is because of the content piece of it. It's not because the service is hard to use. It's not because it costs an exorbitant sum. It's because of the way their terms are written. It sort of sounds like, yeah, if you want to use our stuff, that's really great. And we own your content forever and we can do whatever we want with it. And it's really not up to you.
Right.
And so,
But if Spotify were to take that engine mm-hmm. and detach it from these, you know,
terms.
Draconian terms that Anchor presumably decided they needed in order to profit from this engine, if Spotify has another way to profit from this engine, mm-hmm. then they don't have to inherit those draconian terms. They never have to use them ever even once.
Right.
So I think that's where this is going and why Spotify has done what they do. Tom Webster of Edison Research is one of the smartest people I know in general. And he's also a big fan of, also he is a podcaster, but he's a fan of podcasting and has been following podcasting both personally and professionally for 14 years, like basically as long as podcasting has existed. Mm-hmm. And which is great because, you know, Edison every year releases all their podcast metrics and they've been tracking this stuff for a very long time, which is awesome. And that's all because it led by Tom. I don't want to say everybody, like, Tom's the only one that does that work. That's not true. But Certainly he was the one that spearheaded and leads this charge. He posted something this morning about this acquisition. And so I don't want to take credit for it, but I do want to share it. And he saw two very specific benefits to this acquisition. Number one is to Spotify. I think he said somewhere about 90% of the content that is currently played on Spotify is something for which Spotify then has to turn around and pay a royalty for. Every time you stream a song by, you know, Justin Timberlake or Van Halen or anybody that currently has a copyright, they get their royalties for that. That's how it should work. And I think it's usually about a third of a cent is how that works. Anyway, that's just neither here nor there. If Spotify can make more and more of their content podcasts, royalties don't need to be paid on that content. So Spotify gets to either keep their, you can look at it in one of two ways. They keep their costs down, which makes their profits larger, or you can say they keep their costs down, which keeps our costs of using Spotify lower. Mm-hmm. Perhaps this gives them an unfair competitive advantage over like Apple Music or Tidal or, you know, anyone else offering a streaming service, Amazon Prime Music, because they are able to stream content to you that doesn't cost them anything, and so maybe, you know, if they pass that along, then now they're cheaper than these others, et cetera. So that's
which
one.
Is a really interesting idea when you stop and think about it. Is like, you know, when you think about a streaming service, you think about them streaming music, and anybody streaming music is paying to stream that music. Like, yes, it's a small amount. It's not even an entire cent for every song that you play, but it's still an amount. And, you know, when you stretch that across everybody, like, yeah, there is a certain cost to being Spotify in that respect. So anything that they can do to make that less is interesting. So what's the other piece?
Well, the other piece is if you are a podcaster, there is no way, I say no way, and of course I immediately think of the exception to this rule, but there's no way that you are going to start a podcast that focuses primarily on copyrighted music, on playing copyrighted music, because
all the way through.
Yeah, because you can play little snippets and probably get away with it. But if you were to just say, hey, I'm Dave and I want to play you my favorite classic rock songs once a week for an hour, like, the chances that I could be profitable with that long term without having boatloads of lawyers banging down my door are pretty slim.
Right.
Even if I wanted to be like,
I would listen to that show, though.
I would absolutely listen to that show.
Well, so here's the thing, right? So like Brian Ibbett at Coverville, and he's the exception I thought of. He has been producing Coverville for almost 15 years, I want to say now, but certainly 14 plus. And he, his show is playing cover versions of songs that you might or might not know.
Right.
And it's a great show.
It's such a good show. Yes.
If you're into music, it's fun because he finds these obscure little things and it's interesting to hear these songs in different ways. He went and signed up with ASCAP and BMI and CSAC, all the rights and royalty payment agencies, years and years ago. They had at the time no idea how to deal with him.
No clue what to do.
They still don't, because they're arrangements with the artists, you know, is this streaming? Well, no, they're downloading it. Wait a minute. Somebody has a copy of my song. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it works. Is there DRM on it? No, it's just an MP3. Right. So like this becomes a very strange thing. He has stayed out of harm's way by paying these royalty agreements that are largely pretty small, but it's not something that can be replicated at scale.
Right.
So think about this, though. Spotify does have those arrangements. Spotify does allow you to download songs to your device and play them time shifted, if you look at it this way, right? Or you can stream them, but because it's baked within the Spotify app, it's all protected. You can't extract the music or the music out of there. So now Spotify has an engine that they just bought from Anchor that allows people to create podcasts on Anchor's platform. Right. Mm-hmm. So now that's Spotify's platform. Now maybe I can go create my Dave's favorite classic rock songs once a week and distribute it through Spotify. Spotify takes care of the licensing. I can actually make this show and Charlotte can actually listen. without having to know me personally.
First of all, I can't wait to hear that show. The other thing that I think about when I was listening to, or not listening to, but reading more about this, and then Dave, listening to you talk about it, a thing that occurs to me is if I am putting my show out using Anchor, like, you know, just to talk about the engine itself, if I'm using Anchor to post that show and that's all I'm doing, then the only place it's going to go is Spotify, which means when you make Dave's Week in Classic Rock, right, then it's not going to show up anywhere else. Now, you being you have the technology, you know, to put it wherever you want, and it can go out on
rights to put it wherever I want, and that's the difference, right?
Right. It'll, but if I was making a podcast,
can only exist on Spotify,
right? But if I'm making one that's not musical, and I just am a person who has really decided that I want to make a podcast about some TV show or whatever, and I just want to talk about it, and I want to have Charlotte on the show with me and talk about it, and I take it and I use Anchor to do that because I've been told that Anchor is a really easy way to do that. The only way the only way anyone can hear my show is by going to Spotify. And so people are going to go to Spotify and find a whole nother world of stuff there that they don't have in other places.
You got
it. Or are they? And this
is Spotify's gamble, I would think.
Right. I think this is to me the crux of the issue. Is turning yourself into a platform for certain shows, and the platform where you can only listen to certain shows, going to work? Is it going to work for Spotify, which will probably be okay, but is it going to work for podcasters? Are people producing shows that they record on Anchor and then are published only on Spotify, which I think is a fair assumption that will be the arrangement. Mm-hmm. Are enough people going to listen to it?
So let me answer you by pointing at Netflix and Hulu.
Netflix is a very good example, and clearly Spotify thinks it can be.
Right. I mean, they want to be the Netflix of audio, obviously.
Right. Yeah. Do they want to be the YouTube of audio, in which case that's not going to happen.
Oh, that's true. Right. Because with Anchor, if they employ Anchor's engine the way we have, speculated here, then you're right. They become the YouTube of audio, not just the Netflix.
Right.
It's not like with Gimlet, they get the Netflix, right? The individually or the internally curated and created shows with Anchor, they get the outside stuff. So I think this buy makes the more we talk about it, the more I like what we see here. But, do we want Spotify to become the only place that one listens to podcasts? That sounds scary to me as a podcaster. So
my knee jerk on that is no.
Right.
Yeah. As fun as it would be to do the radio show, let's air quote it, radio show, as fun as Classic Rock Weekly with Dave Hamilton is going to be when it happens, fingers crossed, when that happens, if the only place I can hear it is Spotify, that's almost a strike against it in a way to me as a person who is not primarily going to Spotify for podcasts now.
But I
would have to make a special trip.
Yeah. 3 years down the road, does it? Or 18 months down the road? No one flinches at, I have to watch that show on Netflix. I have to watch that show on HBO. No one cares. It's like, okay, I just launched that app and I'm good to go. So I'm totally with you that I don't like this walled garden thing, but I also know how quickly we as humans get used to it when it's the most convenient way to do it. And so we just do that.
Yep. Right. So I'm interested to see where this goes. I think all of us are. And I think we will find out. So when we do, we will talk to you more about it. And I will have Dave Hamilton back on to pimp Dave Hamilton's Week in Classic Rock. Thanks for being on the show.
I might not want to stay pigeonholed in Classic Rock, but we'll start. The first episode will be that, solely to honor this particular conversation that we've had here today.
Yes. An hour of music a week with Dave Hamilton, whatever we end up calling it. It'll have a better name, I promise.
It might. But it doesn't have to. That's the beauty of creating it on your own.
Exactly. So, Dave, thanks for being with us today. I look forward to your show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Also with me, Charlotte Henry. Thanks for being with us today, Charlotte.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I've been your host, Kelly Gamont. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. In the meantime, be excellent to each other.